than an ideal Yahwistic society, or a society that God outlines, as outlined in the book of Deuteronomy and other books of the first five books of the Bible, is to be established in the land. Genocide. You wipe out a whole race or group of people in order to put something else in place. And there's plenty of examples. This is some people who are wanted from the Rwandan genocide, but you could have all sorts of other examples of people and situations. ISIS, for example, have been wiping out the Yazidis and various other people, Christians, in the areas that they control. Wonder if you know where this is. It's Anne Frank's house. And I don't know how many of you have been there, but we went there a few years ago. And it's you saw where they hid, and you heard the story and all that sort of thing. And in the basement, the place to the right-hand side of it, is now a sort of instruction place, a little school for how to deal with genocide, how to approach it as people, how we ought to view it, how we can prevent it. And when we compare the genocide in Joshua with some of modern examples, like the Nazis trying to wipe out the Jews, the Nazis thought that there ought to be a pure Aryan race, and this warranted destroying the Jews. But a lot of economic arguments could be advanced for the Nazis. For example, the Jews owned a lot of property. They were quite wealthy. And this was eventually apportioned to the Aryans as the final solution progressed. And this we can compare with the idea of the land of Canaan, a big natural resource, being the sole possession and right of the Israelites. Now, in case you think that that's all very well, you know, that we're not like the Nazis, what about North America? What about the conquest by the white settlers, of mostly of European origin, owning the land from east coast to west? And they had a doctrine at some stage of manifest destiny. In the US, the natives were to be destroyed in this process, and a society of freedom and democracy founded in its place. For example, in 1830, the American president, Andrew Jackson, together with the great cotton states of Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, outlawed the tribal kingdoms of the Red Indians and ordered them to move west of the Mississippi. The Cherokees appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Chief Justice, John Marshall, upheld their claim that there was no constitutional right to remove them from their ancestral lands. President Jackson called this decision too preposterous, and in what is one of the most shameless and arbitrary acts of an American president, simply ignored the Supreme Court and said to the army, "Get them out." So on what was later called the Trail of Tears, 30,000 Cherokees were persuaded or chained, gently led or viciously driven, as far west as Oklahoma. And along the way, a quarter of them died. Did you watch Dances with Wolves, the film, with Kevin Costner? This is the sort of thing that he portrays with the Sioux Indians. And in fact, the last battle with Red Indian tribespeople took place as late as 1891, ending in a massacre of the Lakota Indians. And so finally, the Indians were subdued. Someone has commented, 500 years of Western domination, that's us, folks, has been marked by a history of conquest, think of the British Empire, subjugation and genocide never before seen in the world in its scope and scale. And it's still happening. We support survival in a very minor way. It's a group which is wanting to preserve the lives of indigenous tribespeople in various parts of the world. Because big companies, mostly Western, say, get them off their land, we want to dig up the minerals, dig up the oil, whatever it might be. So it's still happening. So we return to our difficult question. How can we reconcile God's orders to wipe out a nation with Jesus' words? Love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. Well, just have another think with your neighbour about this for a moment. What do you feel at this moment? Well, I'm hoping that you don't feel too great. And yet, we see Joshua, don't we, as a hero. Be bold, be strong. Da, 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 da. And I guess he would have said, if we'd have questioned him, Joshua, why did you do this? I was only following orders. Where have we heard that before? Joshua fought the battle of Jericho, and it's a Negro spiritual, but the reality recorded when the walls came tumbling down was, Joshua 6:21, then they devoted all in the city to destruction, both men and women, young and old, children, oxen, sheep, donkeys, with the edge of the sword. So you can understand why people like Charlie Hebdo in Paris, you know, the satirical magazine, portrays God as a sort of malignant, mad mullah with a Kalashnikov on his back. And the title there is 1 year on from the massacre of the people in the offices of Charlie Hebdo, the assassin is still out there. And they mean God. And then this man. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction, because he thinks it's fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. That's in his book, The God Delusion. And then Stephen Fry. The Ten Commandments are the hysterical ramblings of a desert tribe. The Ten Commandments are restrictive, oppressive, and designed to appease a totalitarian God who is utterly evil, capricious, and monstrous if he were to exist. So you can see that the militant atheists, secularists of today, take the moral high ground over Christians. Because they say they're superior to Christians, because Christians, like us, have been guilty of terrible things. The Crusades, the Inquisition, the Protestant versus Catholic wars in Europe after the Reformation, and the religious persecution, for example, that saw the Pilgrim Fathers escape persecution in England and Holland to found a colony in the Americas. Christian theologian Walter Wink says, against such an image of God, the revolt of atheism is an act of pure religion. Okay, so how do we deal with what's Christian theologian Phyllis Trible has called the texts of terror? How can we reconcile God's instructions to utterly destroy the Canaanites in the Old Testament with Jesus' command to love your enemies in the New Testament? Well, it's with great difficulty. So we need to get back to Joshua and the conquest of Canaan. Why did this happen? Well, if you've seen the Star Wars prequels, you'll know what I'm about to do. This is a prequel. The prequel is the account of Abraham having an encounter with God in Genesis chapter 15 in Hebron, in the land of Canaan, where Abraham was to become Abraham, questions God about remaining childless. And God reassures him that he will have a son. And God makes a covenant with Abraham. A covenant is a binding agreement between two parties. It defines their relationship, sets out the duties and the consequences that are part of those covenant obligations. So if you get married in an Anglican church, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, sickness and health, to love and to cherish, to death us depart, are the covenant obligations of marriage. And God says in this covenant with Abraham that his descendants will need to spend many years exiled from the land that he promises to give them, where Abraham is currently situated in Hebron, and his descendants, but that one day they would return. Genesis 15. As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abraham, and behold, a dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abraham, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners, temporary dwellers, in a land that is not theirs, and they will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve," which was the Egyptians, "and afterwards they'll come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You'll be buried in a good old age. And they," that's your descendants, "will come back here to Canaan in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." The iniquity of the Amorites, the people dwelling in the land of Canaan, is not yet complete. Derek Kidner, an Old Testament commentator, says, the clause about the iniquity of the Amorites not being complete throws significant light on Joshua's invasion and, by inference, the other Old Testament wars. They're not aggressive acts so much as acts of justice. Until it was right to invade, God's people must wait, even if it cost them centuries of hardship. It's one of the pivotal sayings of the Old Testament. So there's a prequel to the invasion and the conquest. Secondly, what were these Canaanites, Amorites, whatever you call them, up to? The Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites and Jebusites. Deuteronomy 7. "When the Lord your God brings you into the land you're entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord has delivered them over to you and you've defeated them, you must destroy them totally, make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy." That's a hard saying, don't you think? Well, why did God say that? Well, as we've seen, the Canaanites have what the police call previous. Leviticus 18. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, 'I am the Lord your God.' You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt, where you lived, and you shall not do as they do in the land of Canaan, where I'm bringing you." And then follows a list of things such as incest, child sacrifice, homosexual practice, and bestiality. And it continues in Leviticus 18, "Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things. For by all these things, the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean. And the land has become unclean, so that I punish its iniquity, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. But you keep my statutes and my rules, and do none of these abominations, lest the land vomit you out when you make it unclean, as it vomited out the nation that was before you." And in Deuteronomy 18, When you come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, don't learn to follow the abominable practices of those nations who are there. Don't burn your son or daughter as an offering. Don't practice divination, tell fortunes, interpret omens, become a sorcerer, or a charmer, or a medium, or a necromancer, or one who inquires of the dead. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. And because of these abominations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God. The trouble is, if we compare what happens with Joshua with modern genocide studies, seeing the Canaanites as a threat and the appeal to their sinfulness, it's like a standard strategy of demonization and dehumanization of the opposition in order to rationalize acts of violence against them. In Rwanda, they called the Hutus, called the Tutsis, cockroaches, vermin that must be exterminated. And even if God did want to bring in his own people and clear out a rather corrupt and nasty lot, killing children as a punishment for killing children. So what else can we say about these texts of terror? Well, another thing we could say is that it was a limited event. It only happened on this occasion, or this season, of, as it were, God's people's history. And in fact, God gave instructions, both for the conquest, but also rules of engagement with other situations in wars. And the events that we're describing in the conquest took place largely within just one single generation and in the context of a holy war. Let's look at the instructions for this campaign. When you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it, and if it responds to you peaceably and it opens to you, then all the people who will be there shall do forced labour for you and serve you. But if it makes no peace for you, but makes war against you, then you'll besiege it. And when the Lord God gives it into your hand, you shall put all its males to the sword. Etc., etc. But in the cities of the peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, that's the Canaanites, you shall save nothing alive that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction in order that they may not teach you to do all according to all their abominable practices which they have done for their gods, so that you sin against the Lord your God. What else can we say? You've got to look at all biblical texts in their context. You can't just read it like a science textbook. You've got to treat it as historical documents. And any historical document needs to be put into its own context so you understand the situation which it was speaking to before you think about it speaking to you in your situation. So what is the context that they're in? Well, it's the late Bronze Age. That's 1500 BC to 1200 BC, right? It's a long time ago. It's before the Iron Age. All right? I think. People who've investigated that time of 1500 BC said that war was a common feature in life in the ancient Near East. Well, it's still a feature in the modern Near East, come to that, isn't it? War. It was an expectation of life lived in the context of limited resources of unpredictable supply. Modern ideas of a separate religious structure and ideology, and modern ideas about the inherent wrongness of warfare and automatic opposition to warfare from religious institutions are foreign to the ancient world. To the modern mind, the notion that religion could be used in support of warfare is somehow indecent. But such sensitivities do not fit the context of the Old Testament. The purpose of battle is to destroy an enemy seen as a pollutant, and the level of killing is excessive to modern sensitivities. Well, actually, it's not that different from what's going on today in different parts of the world. Think about Bosnia. Think about Kosovo. Think about Iraq. Think about Afghanistan. Anyway, was God accommodating himself to the customs of the fallen world, which it is, to the customs of that time? Another Old Testament scholar called Chris Wright says this: in a fallen world where the struggle for land involves war, and the only kind of war that was going on was the kind described in the Old Testament, this is the way it had to be. Don't know what you think of that. Colin Chapman, another scholar, says, what we see in the Bible is the gradual process by which God works in the history of a particular people for whom war is an essential part of the religion and the culture. By working in them, he transforms these ideas to enable humans to understand more clearly the nature of the world we live in. And he would argue that as you go towards the New Testament, a different idea is coming through about what God wants for us. And another thing in the context is holy war. People devoted, well, let's think of Osama bin Laden. Okay, he justified the attack on the Twin Towers in New York because of the defilement of unbelievers treading on the soil of the holy nation of Saudi Arabia, and particularly the sites of Jeddah and the other holy city. And he called for Muslims to rise up in jihad, holy war. But holy war or jihad is not a Muslim invention, because Moses and Joshua engaged in campaigns of ethnic cleansing. And they argued that this was holy war, cherem. You know Boko Haram? It's the same sort of root of word. It means unclean, in the sense that haram means unclean, but Western education unclean, Boko Haram. But cherem in its root means a sort of holy and set apart for God, an act of religious devotion. Another Old Testament scholar called Hess argues, how could a loving God command the wholesale extermination of nations that inhabited the Promised Land? No easy answer. But you've got to put it into context. This is the Misha steel. And if you go to Louvre in France, you'll see this. This is from 840 BC, so it's a little bit after the Joshua conquest. And in it, Misha, the king of Moab, records how he took the town of Nebo from Israel. What did he do? He killed everyone in it and devoted it to his god, Ashtar Chemosh. So it is cherem, and everybody was doing it, if you see what I mean. It was common in the Near East of the time. All wars waged by countries in those times were holy wars and dedicated to the glorification of their own god and the extension of their god's reign. So, this whole thing about the Bronze Age, holy war, but it has to do also with judgment. And that's something I have not preached on very much, because I'm a nice guy, see? I'd much rather not preach on this sort of thing. But judgment is something that God talks about and Jesus talked about. Now let's think about judgment. God judges sin because he's holy, He won't tolerate it, and he acts against it. Cherem is a devoted thing, and consequently a thing to be destroyed. So God acts in cherem, or instructs people to act in cherem. It's a worship term, and it involves consecrating the giving over of a situation or a people to God in war. So when Joshua in 6:21 devoted all the city to destruction, it's that word cherem, both men and women, young and old, etc., etc. And God judges sin. So God's ultimate purpose in blessing all nations, Abraham, Genesis 12, doesn't stop him from acting in judgment on particular nations in history, any more than our long-term and loving desire for our children as parents to flourish stops us from disciplining them or punishing them in the meantime to help them to grow up to be what we want them to be. And in any case, when the Israelites worship the golden calf in Exodus 32, Moses is commanded to tell the Levites to kill the idolatrous people of Israel, and 3,000 of them died, and God also, to back it up, struck them with a plague in Exodus 32. And funnily enough, it's because God had this unique relationship with Israel that he acted to punish their sin. What about Amos 3? Hear this word that the Lord has spoken against you, O people of Israel, against the whole family I brought up out of the land of Egypt. You only have I known of all the families of the earth, in the sense of having a special relationship with you. You only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. So God judges his own people. It's not just other people. And it seems that God not only judges his own people, but he uses them to act out his judgment on other people. And he said, you know, if you act in the same way as the Canaanites, we've seen that, you'll be punished just the same. And I will use another nation to punish you. And of course that happened. Deuteronomy 28 predicted this. The Lord will bring against you a nation far away if you sin, and he'll scatter you among the peoples from one end of the earth to the other. So God did, through Israel's long history, judge his own people. And of course, the exile was one of those occasions. What do we think about judgment? What do we think about God's judgment? Is it fair or unfair? Was God fair to judge the Canaanites in the way that he did? You remember Abraham arguing with God about Sodom, wanting to spare it? Abraham saying to God, a little Jewish man shaking his fist at God, saying, "Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is right?" And we might ask God, more humbly than Abraham, why the Canaanites? Why not others? Why that particular generation of Canaanites? There's a problem with what you and I might call fairness within human history in a fallen world. So, for example, did the generation of Israelites that went into exile in Babylon deserve to go more than all the generations that were just as wicked before them? Well, Ezekiel chapter 18, Ezekiel says, this is a problem, God. You know, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. In other words, it's the father's fault, are the children to blame? But it seems that God's judgment, he decides it has to fall at some particular time, and some people will be there at the time the judgment falls, and others will not. It's not fair, but it's unavoidable, unless God were to stop judging all generations within human history. And this whole thing about God's fairness in judgment points towards the final reckoning, when God will put all things right ultimately so that justice prevails and reigns throughout the cosmos in a way that will be universally fair. In the meantime, we live in a provisional and penultimate history of humankind. And, as John Goldingame, my Old Testament tutor at college, said, God harnesses unfairness to accomplish his wider and longer-term purposes for the salvation of the world. And in case we're sort of getting fed up with God about his judgment, what about his blessings? Isn't it unfair that we have had breakfast this morning? We're not in a war situation. We're not refugees in a camp in Calais. We're sitting here in a nice, warm, comfortable church with nice people. Isn't this unfair that we've got this and many other people haven't? Well, the answer is yes, it is unfair. But it's life. Jesus talked about the final judgment, when ultimate justice will happen. And we know that Hebrews says that people are destined to die once and after that to face judgment. And I've got lots of texts about judgment I can give you, but we've got to go. So, one thing we can say about this, are the texts that we read from Joshua verbatim accounts of what happened or interpretations? Because they were written many hundreds of years, or finally came to be many hundreds of years later than Joshua. And in any case, when you examine the texts more, you can see that the extermination was not as complete as Joshua might suggest. So we've got to think about how we interpret any biblical text. And then we get to this problem which I faced you with. Some people, you say thinks we should just dismiss the Old Testament and just listen to the New Testament instead. But in fact, I don't think that's right. I think we need to take into account the paradox of the Old and the New being together there as our Christian texts. And in any case, if we want to eliminate paradox, we need to stop being Christians, because there's a lot of paradox. The first shall be last. You find your life by losing it. You who stoop lowest, climb highest. Where sin abounds, grace abounds more. All these paradoxes are in the New Testament. And truth in paradox is not in the middle, but in both extremes. I put this bicycle picture in here because for me it's a very helpful thing. If you've got two pedals on a bicycle, I pedal around on my bicycle, one says, God is a God of love. The other says, God is a God of judgment. When I need to think about God being a God of love, I press down on that pedal. But the trouble is, the judgment bit comes up. But I've got to press down on that, because sometimes that is actually true. And then I find God of love is the pedal coming up, so I press down on that. And the funny thing is when you press down on both extremes, both different pedals, as it were, you make progress forward. If you stop pressing, you fall off. And that's what it is with paradox. So what do we think about paradox? Think about the background history of whatever we're looking at. Think about the context it's in. Think about our thoughts about God and how we look at life. Think about the conventions of the time and how people express what they believe to have been happening. and how we might interpret things differently from people who wrote the text that we look at. But in the end, it's mystery. We just don't know, ultimately. I wish I could give you a definitive answer, but I can't. So this is the thing that we're left with. And people might say to us, "You're a Christian. How can you reconcile the bloodthirsty God of the Old Testament with the God of love in the New Testament?" And I think this is why we need to give this sort of issue more thought, especially in small groups. If you want the text of my sermon, which is a lot longer than what I actually gave you, I've got it as a Word document and I can give it to you.